You're listening to MedX, the Medical Extrusion Podcast, presented by U.S. Extruders. Extrude with confidence, custom extrusion equipment designed for you and your application.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the MedX Podcast. Today's guest is Jacob Dosi, CEO of Miko Manufacturing, based in Germany. Miko Manufacturing is a global contract manufacturer that specializes in high-precision laser processing of materials. Enjoy. Jacob, thanks for carving out some time to join us on the MedX Podcast today.
Steve, thank you for having me. Really excited about it.
Yeah, I'm excited. Of course, anytime somebody wants to talk about nitinol, I'm in. And I know we're going to talk about laser processing of nitinol and other specialty materials and polymers. So real excited about this conversation. Before we get into some of these real interesting technical laser processing material topics, first, if you can, please give us an overview and background of Miko Manufacturing.
Yeah, sure. Pleasure to talk a little bit more about Miko and how it has evolved over time. So Miko Manufacturing was actually founded in 1991, so around 33 years ago, by my father-in-law. And he was a PhD from a laser institute here in Hanover, Germany. And then in 1991, he decided that he wanted to be independent. He wants to be self-employed and sort of do his own business. And he didn't have a clear plan about doing medtech or nitinol wasn't even out there, but having a plan to do medtech. So he decided to focus on special things. He always focused on high precision. So he really liked the challenge when there was customers coming or potential customers coming out there and saying, well, can you do this for me? And then they said, oh, and we've tried three or four other laser job shops. Then he was really interested because he liked the challenge. He liked the high precision. He liked the things when other people said, you cannot do that, then he really liked doing it. And I think that's how Miko got into the medtech market. In 1995, there was a company from Israel coming to him and saying, well, can you make this part for me? And at the time, they told him it would be some sort of electrical resistor, while he later found out that it was actually a cardiovascular stent and was actually one of the first cardiovascular stents being cut in Europe. Mm-hmm. After he found out that he was actually really onto something here, he started targeting the medtech market. And this is basically how Miko has evolved over time. So he joined all the trade shows that are out there, MD&M, but also the European ones, and he targeted that market. And nowadays, 33 years later, Miko is one of the contract manufacturers for medical device components. More than 90% of what we do is supporting and is going into the medtech market. And I also want to highlight that we've always been a contract manufacturer, so we've never had and never engaged into any sort of device manufacturing, but we always make components, and that's our sweet spot, what we like to do.
That's an interesting story, and I kind of read some of, or listened to it on your podcast. You have some great webinars, as I mentioned earlier, three that I listened to, and there was a good background. It's funny that he didn't even know it was for medical, right? And here you are, 90%, like you said, is all focused on medical, and you've grown through the years. So that's a really interesting story. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, and I mean, if you imagine nowadays, I mean, if you look at 1995, the regulatory questions, the ISO certifications, test method validations, FMEAs, what everything we talk about nowadays has been very different back in the days. So yeah. I think once you find out that you are targeting the medtech market, you have to evolve over time to also let regulatory bodies like the FDA and European MDR know what you're doing and support the activities that you're doing. So that's actually very different now than it was back in the days.
Gosh, it's been very different now, even 5 years ago, right? Yeah. From a regulatory standpoint with MDR, like you mentioned, you know, there's just having a conversation, get a little bit off topic, but having a conversation with a regulatory person in the US. And for the contract manufacturers, the OEMs are always been passing more down to the contract manufacturers, but they're also passing more of the regulatory burden. And it's more, you know, things that the regulatory folks aren't necessarily accustomed to, environmental, some of these other social items that The OEMs are pushing down. So it's creating kind of an overhead issue, right? Not issue, but you have to increase your overhead and the regulatory to stay up with all this.
Yeah, that's definitely true from our side. I think when we look at the times 10 years ago, we were basically having one quality manager and he was managing all the audits. And nowadays it's more than a handful of people looking after all those things. And also the burden on department leaders, on production managers to look at regulatory and to take it into account has become a lot more critical. And understandably so. So I think we do support that. And we also do support the idea that OEMs are passing down some of that complexity that they have had internally down to the contract manufacturers.
Right. It's a big, it's a lot of work. It's a more challenging and people are having to bring on more people to support it, which is fine. You know, right. It's like you said, from 5 years ago, big change. Let's move on to one of my favorite topics, and that's Nitinol, the biocompatibility, super elasticity, shape memory. As somebody recently told me, it's a magic material, right? So many things that you can do with it. Yeah. Also with the post-processing after laser processing, electropolishing, we can get into that. But tell us a little bit about the work that you do in laser processing of nitinols. You have this beautiful TAVR, I think it's a TAVR or structural heart frame that you sent me. I'll let you talk a little bit.
Basically, if you look at that design, I think it's supposed to be somewhat of a crown, more like art than it's an actual device. But mm-hmm. we usually try to make our samples so that they don't interfere with any sort of customer design because we protect the intellectual property of our customers. So that's why we came up with some beautiful designs that do show a lot of features that you may need on TAVR and other sort of frames. But basically, we are trying to show something, show the basic capabilities. I think our nitinol manufacturing started around 24 years ago. So we were not, would say, at the forefront of the device manufacturers as we've seen in maybe in the US and on the West Coast. But in 2000, I think we started to establish all the processes that we see around shape setting, that we see around electropolishing, about passivation, marker crimping, marker welding. So there's a lot of different technologies out there. And these processing methods, they can be aligned and custom tailored so that the specification of the customer is met. And I think that has also, I mean, evolved a lot over time. I mean, back in the days in the 2000s, we weren't looking so much at things like fatigue life, the simulation part, finite element analysis wasn't really a big deal. And nowadays, I think from the design of the shape setting tools over evaluation of fatigue life, over finite element analysis, I think there's a lot of competencies around simply manufacturing nitinol devices that you need to include and that you need to take into account in order to be successful to make successful medical device components, I would say.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, beyond just laser processing, like you said, there's so much more to it. What can you tell me about, you know, there's so much activity in R&D and development, and R&D engineers want samples like this on their desk, right? Quickly to do a prototype. How do you, in such a unique material and process, how do you support R&D folks on prototypes?
So I think that's been a great challenge also for us to reduce our lead times for prototypes, to get things moving as fast as we can. And I think the first step that we had to take into account was to establish all of these processes in-house. So mm-hmm. when in the beginning, maybe you had someone doing the FAA analysis outside, maybe you had someone who did the shape setting tool, maybe the customer did it, maybe someone else did it. Then you had to manufacture the shape setting tools. And I mean, nowadays we want to support prototyping lead times of less than 2 weeks. And that hasn't been possible with so many outside vendors. Mm-hmm. So one of the key elements to that was to get most of these processes in-house. So even now, when it comes to manufacturing the shape setting tools that are maybe include maybe a 3D metal printing process, but also include some turning or some milling, then we also have included all that in-house so that we are really able to make new tools overnight and to adapt and to a custom when we are not happy with specification or we are not happy with the tolerances. Then we can overnight, we can rebuild the tools and have a new round the next day. So that has been very important for us to integrate all that and to support shorter lead times. And on the other hand, I think it's also a lot about the planning in your manufacturing department. Maybe there is a unique, some uniqueness in our manufacturing as well, that we don't have a dedicated prototyping department. We don't have dedicated machinery. We use our standard equipment. And that's also, it's not just the advantage that you can use that capacity. If you don't have a prototype, you can use that capacity for serial production as well. But the biggest advantage here is that you are running everything on validated machines, and you can even use some of the prototypes that you've done and some of the prototyping runs also for your validation later on. So you don't have to start from scratch when it comes to V&V phases and everything that comes after. And that's, I think, one of the advantages that we have by using that that planning and that organization.
Okay, that makes sense. A couple times you mentioned finite element analysis, FEM, and fatigue life related to even the prototypes early stage. Can you talk a little bit how are you utilizing some of these modeling tools to look at fatigue life and stress and strain and things like that?
So I think so far the finite element modeling or finite element analysis is on the one hand is focused on the shape setting. So we do calculate how many shape setting steps do we need, how many tools do we need, and so that we don't harm harm the material during processing. And of course, if we remain below certain elongations, then we also know that later on we have less issues with fatigue life, I would say, or we don't have early breakages, I can say. So the modeling part is not so much related to the fatigue life, but it does sort of influence that, or it may lead to early problems if we don't get it right here. The fatigue life, of course, it's a lot about material selection. When we look at the tubing manufacturers that we use, all the sources, they have also created a lot of different options to tailor the material to custom applications. So back in the days, in the 2000s, there was just a single specification for nitinol material, and inclusion sizes weren't that much of a problem. I think there was a basic specification around that. And over time, these specifications have been upgraded, and also beyond the ASTM standards, there has been a lot of industry related proprietary specifications that we now see in the drawings that the customer sends to us. And sometimes when you work with startups, of course, you also have to teach these a lot. And these webinars, for example, they are related to education a lot. So we're trying to educate the customer early on. And I also want to mention one thing that we try to do is to keep the costs from the beginning on low. So if we think that a customer doesn't require very high performance material for the application, because maybe it's a class 2 device, or maybe it's somewhat of a device that doesn't have a lot of fatigue life issues, then we really try to push to use the most economic or the most economic material, because then when you set it early on, it's hard to change it later. So starting with the easiest, most economic, and then if we see issues or we think that the application requires something more advanced, then we suggest that. But that's, I think, always part of our strategy, is to educate the customer towards making parts that are economic also in serial production. Another example here would be that when we look at, for example, measurements that we take for the customer, sometimes smart startups, they come with a ton or dozens of measurements that we have to take on those parts, and then we try together with the customer to change the specification or to educate the customer towards setting the requirements that are basically more economic than just doing hundreds of measurements or dozens of measurements on a single part and trying to reduce the effort here in order to be able to keep the costs also for the customer and on at the end also for the patient as low as possible in the end and while still maintaining safety, of course.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. That makes sense. Kind of the material selection is a big part of that. And we're going to talk about some of the different materials, but related to a stent that you laser process, regardless of those materials, there's different functionality requirements, the crimping, radial strength to keep the lumen open, fatigue, corrosion, biocompatibility, and the ability to see these devices under fluoroscopy or x-ray. Can you talk a little bit how you integrate radiopacity into a machined laser process stent?
I think we have developed multiple processes around that. I mean, probably some of the older technologies are using crimp marker bands on there. Mm. And then over time, and they are still used and they are still valid. So I don't want to call them obsolete, but they're quite necessary for some components. But over time, we've seen a lot of demand also for using small eyelets, for using custom-made radiopaque markers, and we use multiple materials here. So conventional sort of the parts use gold. Some use platinum iridium. Mm-hmm. We also use tantalum a lot, and then there's multiple processes to integrate them. So you can sort of press them in, you can punch them in, and to create some sort of a modification of the size or to create some force towards the eyelet. But we also have established a welding process so that we can weld those markers in, and we do get a lot higher retention forces in that, because sometimes when you have a fatigue influenced part, you may have the problem that a marker may fall out, which may create somewhat of a serious risk, especially if it mm-hmm. happens early on. And so the welding method has been quite beneficial for us. And I think one of the nice features that we can also do, the eyelets, they can have any shape at all. And
yeah.
We created one nice sample part where we've actually, nice shapes integrated into that so that you can really see how you can tailor them.
I noticed that on the other, the smaller stent that you sent me, it had pretty unique shape. I can't show it. You have a picture of it that I'll show in the unboxing. You can't see that. Ah, a little bit.
Yeah, it's a little bit small to show. Yeah. So these radiopaque markers, they do have sizes from, I would say, 150 microns up to 600, 700 microns. I'm sorry about the millimeters metric system.
No problem.
You can do the conversion.
Yeah. We're used to
it. And I think that's maybe one thing to highlight is always the, that's I think the nice part that where we get to work with so many different people from so many different countries, that there's a lot more than just the European sort of metric system and the language barrier. And I think that's what makes our job as well always interesting and keeps it interesting.
I imagine the percentage of your revenues are highly related to exports.
And we do share that number that more than 50% of our export or of our revenue comes from outside of Europe. So that's and even in Europe we have a good export ratio. So it's quite important to be active all across the board.
Yes, absolutely. Let's move on to Resoloy. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And that's your reabsorbable magnesium alloy for scaffolds and stents. And, you know, I just told you how nitinol is magical and there's so many other specialty metals. So just in the beginning, why a reabsorbable material in the first place? And then we can kind of go on to some of the unique properties.
Yeah. So I think the demand for Resoloy and bioresorbable materials came about in the 2010, 2012, when some big OEMs were starting programs. We were using polylactides, we're using other bioresorbable polymers to build these devices. And on the other hand, we already saw that there might be some metals out there that could be beneficial or that could be used for bioresolvable devices in the stent market. And bioresolvable stents or bioresolvable scaffolds, what they are also called, they come from the hypothesis that maybe the stent is not needed for such a long time or for your whole life. But maybe if you have a healing process in your artery and you may have a drug that you have eluted there, mm-hmm. Then maybe you can get rid of that stent after 6 months, after 12 months. And I mean, it remains to be investigated how long that time will be. And that's when Miko started that material development around 14 years ago. My father-in-law actually started that program, saying, "Let's look into the metal world. What can we do?" Because he didn't really see, I think it was hard to see where polymers would take him. Mm-hmm. And then we looked at different metals. Iron, zinc was across there, but we kind of quickly we came to magnesium and magnesium alloys. We looked at all the things that were out there. So, for example, there's an alloy called WE43 that is out there. And when we looked at it, then we saw that either these materials were designed to be for lightweight production for car makers, for example. Some others that were already a little bit in the medical field, they were designed to mimic bone and other sort of applications, but really didn't see any alloy that was out there that had enough break elongation, so that did have somewhat of the flexibility that you need to crimp it on a balloon catheter and then deploy it in the vessel. And we started custom designing that alloy so that it does have the degradation profile that you need, but that it also has the break elongation and the mechanical properties that you need. And when I look at the beginning, when I started here at Miko back in, I would say, 2013, 2014, mm-hmm. we were basically at 23% break elongation. So that's less than half that you have of conventional cobalt chromium alloys like L605 or MP35N. And nowadays, I think we are at more than 30%. We can even achieve 33, 35%. So it's still somewhat of a magnitude less than mm-hmm. that you have with L605. But when you do design adjustments and when you work with the customer, to adjust the designs, you can make pretty good cardiovascular scaffolds out of that. And to talk a little bit more about the industry and the demand for it, when we saw we had one big product approved in Europe, we had one big product approved in the US, and then shortly, I think in 2015, there was called the AIDA trial that showed that this device actually had significantly higher late stent thrombosis. We saw that the demand for bioresorbable devices and bioresorbable materials was pretty much leveling off, or was even getting to zero, basically. Mm-hmm. But we kept the vision. I think we kept the team, and we kept the desire to create a metal that is bioresorbable, that works for cardiovascular. And I think that's one decision where I really like to be part of a family business, because you mm-hmm. could invest in the long term. And even if we saw that this is not going to create any revenue for years or maybe even for decades, mm-hmm. We still kept working on the technology. And when you look at these conferences now, and when you talk to KOLs, I think there's a lot more demand. There's a lot more devices that are coming out, a lot more interest for that now. So we now have a few programs targeting cardiovascular scaffolds. We even have programs that target heart valve frames that are resolvable. So I think the demand is picking up nicely, and we do have a lot more preclinical experience. So we do get a lot of in vivo data, where we work very closely with our clients to basically get the platform out. And I think one challenge has always been that we don't want to be a device manufacturer. So we want to build the platform where the device manufacturers can draw on. And you have to work very closely with the customer, because if you just manufacture the device and ship it out and you treat it like a conventional cobalt chromium stent, then it will not work. So you have to adjust your crimping, you have to adjust your design, you have to do a lot of your coating process, you have mm-hmm. to do a lot of adjustments together, and that requires very long-term and very close partnerships between customers and contract manufacturer.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought that up. You know, this concept of collaborating and design for manufacturability, it's one of the topics that comes up a lot during the podcasts and also these medical processing panel events that I have. And I would think of something so technical as a drug-eluting degradable stent, yeah, you need to have very close collaboration.
Yeah.
And I also echo what you said. I've seen increased interest in degradable stents and products. And you mentioned a little bit of a lack of interest some years ago. That might have been about the time when I think the Abbott Absorb kind of didn't work out. And I think it was like of a low point, right? And we've come a long way since then.
Yeah, that's the device I was referring to when we saw these late stent thrombosis. Everyone was thinking, okay, do we have a class effect here? Is that about bioresorbable devices? And back in the days, our hypothesis was that it was about PLLA and the amount of PLLA that was put in there. So we do, and we do believe a lot in polymers, and I hope we get to that. So we do believe a lot in bioresorbable polymers. But when you look at replacing a cardiovascular stent to have a new workhorse device in the future, I think we do believe that magnesium has a lot of potential there.
Okay. Very exciting topic. Let's move on to another topic, Vascoloy, which is your nickel-free material. And for stents, I was stunned to learn that some patients are allergic to nickel, and it's, you know, greater than 10%, I believe, and a lot higher for women. I don't know why that is, but you have a solution, a nickel-free solution that has superior tensile compared to 316, I think fatigue, and even better corrosion resistance, or close to the the L605. Tell us a little bit about Vascoloy, kind of from start to finish. It's very exciting.
Yeah, so Vascoloy was a platform that was started a little bit later than Resoloy, because we heard the demand that also some KOLs, some cardiologists, really thought that permanent stenting will still remain even after bioresorbable devices are out there, maybe for older patients, maybe for heavy calcified lesions and everything else. And when you look at the MACE rates, major adverse cardiac events, or the other target lesion failure rates, when you look at drug-eluting stents, you always see this curve going up and going up over time. So even if the first 2 years or 3 years, they look nice, then over time, there's still more complications out there. And the idea around Vascoloy was that maybe when we look at patient populations that are nickel sensitive or even nickel allergic, or cobalt, I think, is another material that that might conflict that, then our hypothesis that some of that TLF and some of that MACE that we see may be related to nickel allergies. We do have the background data, some data from Japan that is suggesting that, but more data coming out there, and also, I mean, the FDA providing more and more guidance on cobalt and nickel. And that's when we said, okay, we need to have an alloy for permanent implants. Doesn't have to be a stent, it could be something else as well, but we need to have an alloy that you can safely use for cardiovascular stenting and for other implants that doesn't have nickel and cobalt. And the basic design principle of that material was that we don't want to compromise on anything here. So we didn't want to compromise on mechanical properties. We didn't want to compromise on corrosion resistance. And that's how we evolved with this iron-based alloy, Vascoloy, where we have very comparable properties, and that basically doesn't require any sort of design change with the stent, from the stent perspective. So you could immediately switch from L605, you could switch from 316L, and you don't have to make any sort of changes to that. So I think that's the interesting part about it. We are also able to include radiopaque markers, because as these designs, they get smaller and smaller. We now are talking about strut sizes of 60 microns, or some are even trying to go below that, which is, I think, feasible from a mechanical perspective. But when it comes to visibility later, when the balloon catheter has been pulled out, I think it's quite interesting to also have some radiopaque markers that are included there. And we do see a lot of interest for that. We also have customers that want to start their first in-human implantations next year. So it's quite it's a long way, and definitely Resoloy, the same as Vasculoy, it's a long way to go forward. But we do think that it will be one of the alloys that will lead the market in the future.
I know there are alternatives or nickel-free materials that can be used for stents, but been on the market for a while. But apparently, one of the downsides, if you can, is the ductility or plasticity for use with a balloon expandable, or maybe even a self-expandable. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in the plasticity or ductility?
I think that's when we started to scan the market and looked at the tubing manufacturers, looked at the raw material manufacturers. We do saw some alloys on the market that had no nickel and had no cobalt in there. But the problem was that the break elongation wasn't at that level where we required it to be. And that's when we started to tweak, tailor, and design our own material. I think I have to highlight one thing here. So Vascular is for balloon expandable devices. So it's a plastically deformable material that you can use for balloon expandable devices. But there is right now no alternative to nickel titanium or nitinol. Unfortunately, I think there is research being done on that. And I do hear some of that. Very interested in that as well. But for now, for all the nitinol manufacturing that we have to do and all the nitinol components, we do have nickel. But I think there's also been extensive testing on nickel leaching on that.
Yeah. Okay. So you're not using nickel. You're replacing it with nitrogen. Is that correct?
In somewhat. I think nitrogen plays an important role in that alloy. But I think the whole base is different. So the whole base of the alloy is iron based. We're all aware of iron is part of our nutrition, is part of our daily consumption of food. So we're very lucky with that. And then the same, actually, when we talk about Resoloy, we're very lucky also with magnesium, because you know that we have to take magnesium every day. And we take it with our water, and it's actually interesting, because when you measure the weight of a stent, it has somewhat of 5 to 8 milligrams of magnesium, and when you drink a liter of conventional mineral water, you have drink like 10 stents or 12 stents. So the amount of magnesium that you put in there is really negligible.
That's interesting. Very interesting. That's great. Those the two products that you have there. Resoloy and Vasculoy are very interesting. Let's move on to polymer tubes, drug integration, and laser processing of polymeric degradable tubing. I know that these bioreabsorbable materials are sensitive to heat, right? So even during the extrusion process, we won't really get too much into that, but too much residence time is a problem, a reduction in molecular weight. Talk to us a little bit how you handle kind of this cold ablation or cold processing of these the polymeric stent materials compared to a metallic stent material.
Yeah, when it comes to processing polymers, but especially also bioresorbable polymers, I think you there was always no way to use conventional fiber lasers or ND-YAG lasers, because the absorption the wavelengths of these lasers, they simply didn't have absorption in these materials. So you could not use the technology that we have used for cardiovascular stents. We saw some early publications beginning in the 2000s that they were using CO2 lasers. They do have the wavelengths to have some absorption, but the power that you put in really doesn't create a low tolerance and sort of precise device. So I think there was no way to use CO2 lasers for that. And back in the 2000s, I think there was a lot of research on ultra short pulse lasers, femto lasers, picosecond lasers. And that's when we already started integrating the technology early on. So I don't remember the year when we had our first USP laser here in-house, but we really started early on, and it took us a long time, or it took us some time to integrate the technology. I have to maybe also highlight that all the machinery that we use in-house to process stents, all the laser equipment, is manufactured, is designed, and is assembled here in-house. Hmm. And has also been over the years a unique distinction and a unique selling proposition, that we can custom tailor our machinery based on the customer requirements. It's always helped us a lot, also in the validation phases, so that we actually knew what was going on in the machine. But we do have to adapt our custom designs that we've used with fiber lasers, that we have used with NDAC lasers, to integrate the USP lasers, because they're usually not driven, or they don't use fibers to get the light basically mm-hmm. to the material. That's when we started to use the USP lasers. We got into the technology, and we started cutting the first polymer stents here back in 2012, 2013. They didn't have to be bioresorbable materials. We also process PTFE, PEK, and all other polymers, because pretty much the technology doesn't really care about the material. That's the nice part. You can use you can do ceramics, metals, and whatever. And I mean, there's a lot of applications also to do some metal cutting, where you are caring about the heat affected zone and other sort of property changes that you might encounter with conventional fiber lasers. Then I think that we were starting cutting bioresorbable stents. There was the question about what happens to molecular weight, and then we had to deal with molecular weight. That was a completely new topic coming from metallurgy, from processing technology for metals. We had to look into molecular weight, and we started to doing measurements of inherent viscosity. We learned a lot from different vendors in the industry, from the raw material sources, from the tubing sources, mm-hmm. and they've helped us a great deal. And we supported each other in investigating on a lot of the technologies that was used to measure inherent viscosity, because it wasn't. I mean, when you have the flakes, or you have the raw material, you have the tubing, you have a lot of mass. But when it comes to a bioresorbable device, you don't have a lot of mass, and measuring viscosity on very low volume parts mm-hmm. Creates somewhat of a challenge, and that's when we learned it. We also have now HPLC, we have GPC in house. So we invested a lot, or SEC it's called in English, mm-hmm. I think, size exclusion chromatography.
Yep.
So we invested a lot into the analytical side of it, to really understand the material and to be able to tailor that. And then we also found out that we have to use a custom wavelength to not to harm the material, not to damage the material over time. So there has been a lot of learnings on that, and there's still a lot of development going on for bioresorbable polymeric devices. We don't know whether these are going to be cardiovascular stents or scaffolds, but we definitely think that there's a lot of devices that will lead to drug eluting devices in a way, or maybe being used in other parts of the body. There's more talks about below the knee stenting mm-hmm. with polymeric devices. So I think there's a lot of opportunity out there, and we see a lot of these prototypes here in house as well.
It's you were talking a little bit about a minute ago about bringing in some of the analytical DSC and these testing, in addition to all the other custom processing equipment and post-processing equipment that you brought in-house. It's quite amazing how you vertically integrated the whole value chain.
Yeah, I think I can elaborate that on that as well, because we did all the metallurgy with Resoloy, with Vasculoy. We started nitinol processing. There was always a demand for a new device, and that's I think how we got more into the material side. And nowadays we have a ton of different technologies, from the device side to measure these devices automatically and precisely, to measure radio forces, and then going back all the way to metallurgy to understand grain sizes, to SEM scanning, to do EDX analysis, to get the elements, or did you get the element analysis done? Mm-hmm. You mentioned DSC, differential scanning calorimetry. We have atomic force microscopes. So there's a lot of different technology here. And then when we draw back, or we go back to the circle of prototyping, this has helped us also tremendously, not going to an outside lab and taking a couple more weeks, but being able to integrate that and give customers quick answers, quick feedback on what we might see as a problem, maybe in a serial production when materials have changed and we see problems there, but also in prototyping when there's a design challenge or there's a challenge between different materials, between marker combinations. We are usually able to integrate and to analyze that quickly.
Okay. Related to bioreabsorbable stents, I know that you've collaborated with one of the, actually, in my opinion, one of the world leaders in when it comes to medical polymer science and the integration of extrusion. And if you can talk a little bit about that partnership, because you've insourced and vertically integrated so many capabilities, but I think you realize that the extrusion of that tubing is so delicate, the uniform wall thickness that they've been able to come up with, and the molecular orientation for the radial strength. If you can talk a little bit about the relationship that you have with this organization and some of the things that you're doing in that area.
Back in the days, 2010, 2012, I think, we were looking at different sources where we could source tubing for bioresorbable scaffolds, because we were already getting inquiries, can you manufacture that scaffold for us? And we were really looking into that, because all the tubing vendors that we had back then were mostly for metallic implants or for metallic materials. So we looked at different sources for bioresorbable polymer tubing. And I think the most promising company back in the days, and it is still now the case, was used from South Carolina. We really saw that they were doing a lot of research on that, on their platform. They call it Absorb. Mm-hmm. So we started sourcing material. In the beginning, it was just for prototyping, just for ourselves to understand what the material is about. We talked a little bit about measuring all that and getting the analytics behind that. But over time, I think we also had more and more customers asking for that. So that's how the relationship really evolved. And we were also starting to having more three-way relationships where customers and Zeus together with us were working on getting these bioresorbable devices out there. And then when we saw that dip, or we saw that failure of Absorb in coronary, we didn't know how Zeus would evolve, but really it was great, because we saw that they were developing that platform. They were still investing in the technology. We were investing on our end. So we were buying more analytics and looking more into different beam sources for ultra short pulse laser cutting. And so basically that relationship became tighter and tighter and closer and closer. And that's how then they had their new refinement, the new platform called Absorb XSE. And we were also working closely together with them to demonstrate how the platform has evolved, how wall thickness tolerances have become lower and lower, how stability of molecular weight has increased, how mechanical properties have increased. And that's how that partnership is really evolving, and has now some very fruitful three-way relationships together with clients that we value, and we value that they do have that research approach as we do.
Yeah, that's great to hear about the collaboration, but also how you both didn't give up when it was really a low point, right? You kept developing, kept grinding, and here we are today. And I think that'll be and I hope that will be a very successful program for both of you.
Yeah. And that's just to mention that it's not always the case. Like, we've seen some relationships where there was maybe an industry failure, or there was some outside activities, like an acquisition or something, and then some of these collaborations stopped. And I think that's really the nice part about this collaboration, that it has gone on over time and evolved.
Great. Well, I wish you both the greatest luck in that area. That's a very exciting technology.
Thank you.
Jacob, this has been a real interesting conversation. I thank you so much for taking the time out to join me on the MedX podcast to talk about these really interesting topics. And I think we're going to have to get you back on in season 3.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Steve, for having me. It was a great pleasure to talk with you. And yeah, we talk soon, hopefully.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll see each other at MD&M West or some show soon.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to MedX, the Medical Extrusion Podcast, presented by U.S. Extruders. Please subscribe to make sure you're getting the latest episodes. For video episodes, go to us-extruders.com/podcasts. All links are available in the show notes.